Broadcasting from the commodity capital of the world, Zurich, Switzerland, this is Insider's Guide to Energy.
This addition to Insider's Guide to Energy is brought to you by Fidectus. Go to www.fidectus.com for more information.
Welcome to a new week and another episode of Insider's Guide to Energy. My name is Johan Oberg and I'm the co-host. Today, joined by one of our colleagues from Stories, Marcelo Ortega. How are you?
How, Johan? It's going well. How about you?
It's been a fantastic week. Summer is coming here in Switzerland. The weather is boiling almost, obviously not compared to where you guys are, but thrilled to be on another show. Maybe before we start, you've been part of the team for quite some time. You've been running our Stories, which has been really interesting to listen to, where we go a little bit more into depth in terms of the people. But maybe quick introduction. Marcelo, who are you?
Yeah, definitely. First of all, I just want to say that your boiling weather in Zurich is nothing compared to the boiling weather that we actually have here in Texas, where I'm located. So to anyone who hasn't listened to Stories, my name is Marcelo Ortega. I'm a host of our sister podcast, where we highlight the track of certain people and how they're traversing their careers in the energy industry. And as a day job, I'm a market analyst for US and Mexico. Specifically, I track policy and developments in solar, wind, and energy storage markets.
Which is a perfect combination of today's show, of course, and we're really happy to have the real experts on here to do this one. We have a really interesting topic today where we're combining a lot of these applications of solar and batteries and also electric vehicles, which is what we've discussed on this show many, many times, the future of this. But how do you combine it? So a part of what I'm really looking forward to hearing today more around is energy companies are talking about this transition into solar. We're talking about EV from the automotive parts, but how do you combine this and what is the impression by the actual customers? How do they affect this? Has that changed in the last couple of years? You know, this is my business hat coming on. This is what I'm really looking forward to hear more about from our guests. Is there anything specific, Marcelo, that you are kind of curious about of the next hour?
Well, I think that what I like to call the smaller side of solar, in this case, commercial and industrial projects, always have very interesting financing mechanisms. I think people get more creative in this space than they would in traditional energy or even utility scale solar projects. So I'm very curious to hear that side of Catalyze's business.
Which is a broad spectrum from interest from us, but we'll see where we're going to head. But with that, I think it's better than to bring on the expert and our guest of honor today, which is Jane Gishwila, from co-founder from Catalyze. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me and us today. And yes, this is James Geschweiler. And thank you, Johan, for pronouncing my name in the original Swiss German way. I love the Switzerdeutsch pronunciation of Geschweiler. My family is very proud now. But yes, I'm in Boston, and Catalyze is a commercial and industrial scale solar battery storage EV charging developer. But very much to your point, we founded the company 5 years ago with the vision that not only was C&I going to finally take off, it had been a bit of the orphan stepchild between resi and utility scale, but that it really needed a new approach, a new company, because these are integrated solutions. And we do a lot of things differently there and look forward to chatting about them.
Sounds great. I'll shoot my first question right away. one of the things we see, my experience is that you looked at the utilities as one part, which is direct relationship with the customers. You have facilities, of course, which is one thing, but you also have the OEMs. They're now trying to dip into the energy a little bit. Tesla obviously gone a little bit further, but also the other ones we see with EV charging and all the rest. How do you see this pan out? Because everyone seems to be a little bit everywhere right now. Is that an assumption that is fairly all right?
Yeah, I think it's a very fair characterization of any early market that everyone's just a little bit everywhere. You have a lot of people nibbling at the edges or trying to have incremental change. I think the honest answer to your question is to actually take a significant step back and say, what actually is generation and what is actually load? The way we actually think about this is we're changing 100 years of history. So back 100 years ago, whether you were in Europe or whether you were in the Northeast United States, you had a factory. This was the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, and it had a power plant associated with it, be it a mill, a coal boiler, and that powered the factory, the means of production, and then it also powered generally the store, maybe the workers' homes here in New England, and back then we called it a factory town. Today, we'd call that same thing, if it were being built from scratch, a renewable energy microgrid. And the reason of highlighting that and going back 100 years is the generation and the means of production were right next to each other. We broke them apart 100 years ago because people thought, hey, this electricity thing's a really good idea. Everybody should have it. So we built these really big central power plants. And people said, well, I don't want it next to my house. I want it over there. Oh, no, farther out, farther out. And then we brought in transmission lines to bring it in back where people would use it. And then for a century, we've had one set of people generate the electricity and another set of people use it. And the reason why we got to come back and like let that sink in is, you know, to Marcelo's point, the economics would be different if we were putting them right next to the economic activity. Simple concepts like resiliency, that I get to keep my factory up and continue to manufacture things, that my hospital doesn't have to invest as much in backup power, that I don't need to have higher levels of infrastructure when I'm adding load through like EV charging because I'm generating on-prem that can feed those vehicles straight, makes you begin to rethink that maybe redesigning from the get-go something that's a bit more contained is going to be better than saying, well, hey, 100 years ago, we made a decision that was a coal plant and now a gas plant way out there. How do we make that work for today's society, today's cost of land, today's existing infrastructure? Both have their places, but I think what we'll get into is there's not necessarily a simple answer. There's a lot of both there, but we got to kind of come back and rethink where is generation and where is load and how are those two going to work together?
I think that's an excellent point, and I've never seen it, you know, as going back to me, that debate of centralized versus decentralized. I thought it was, you know, maybe going forward, but as you put it, it's probably, you know, just rethinking and going back to some of the system characteristics that we used to have. And I'm really glad that you touched on that point, because that was one of the questions that I wanted to ask you. You're working at the CNI space, and for a lot of folks, especially here in the United States, states like California, there's this debate of should power, renewable power, cleaner power come from centralized big scale utility farms, or should it, you know, should residential and CNI that also net meter to the grid be given a priority? Where do you sit in that debate?
Well, again, I think we need to reframe the question, and I don't think it's so much of a debate as it is a little bit of a discussion. I mean, the simple, truthful answer is yes, you need all of it. I think the reframing is that it's the wrong question when it becomes either or gee, how is that going to work with then, and then begin your parade of horribles of duck curve, intermittent generation, clouds, whatever. A lot of that debate, frankly, is framed around people who either have trouble thinking about change, or they're looking at covering their debt service and losing revenue through, frankly, competition. The grid of the future and the utility of the future has a really important role we need to embrace, which is being a market maker. If we stop thinking about this as like a big hub with lots of spokes coming out of it, right? A radial network system. I can use that word on this podcast since we're energy people, right? So the radial system with basically unidirectional power, and think of it more as a mesh and a network. You've now kind of, again, to go back in time, said, hey, in the United States, 40 years ago, we had this thing called the AT&T monopoly, and you paid for long distance, and you had a dumb phone that you paid them to use, and you got charged for long distance. And then we broke up the AT&T monopoly, and then you paid less for long distance because it was competition. And we went to 25 cents a minute and 15 cents a minute and 10 cents a minute. And then, oh, well, wait, you know, what if you call after 7 p.m. or on weekends except Mother's Day? That's a utility scale PPA, and that's the race to the bottom with volumetric consumption, and that's time of use shifting that you're seeing in utility tariffs. Today, we don't even know what a telephone is. The mobile phones we have are more powerful than the supercomputers, the so-called supercomputers we had 20, 30 years ago, and they're interoperable, providing all sorts of data and load balancing and quality of service and multiple forms of communication. This is where we're going with electricity, folks. This is where we're going to multiple products. And when we start talking about resiliency, quality of power, EV load balancing, we also should be really talking about dispatch, neighborhood mutual assistance, and think about, you know, the grid now as a network of networks. And to conclude on this point, you know, the biggest case study that we should look at is Texas. Look what happened last year at Texas. The vulnerability of central power plants that literally froze up, whether they be natural gas or some people pointed, hey, the wind turbines got ice on them. I don't really care if they did or didn't. Centralized assets are centralized assets. What would have happened if we had a bunch of distributed assets interstitially there, or renewables were on rooftops and residents and could be able to detach from the grid and just keep the houses up with basic heat? So you start looking at something that's a lot more of a network rather than, you know, one big power plant that pushes out to everyone. A lot of things begin to change.
I just got to say, I love that answer. And specifically in the Texas grid, it seems like being an operator right now is a hell of a job. There's always a once in a lifetime meteorological event happening every other month. So yeah, to your point, the search for resilience is a big priority. I just want to take you back to something that you said on this transition, which is a different one that we always kind of talk about, from this radial schematic to a network. Where does Catalyze play a role? Does it play a role?
So Catalyze has an interesting overlay to this. Yeah, let's talk about our business model, because when we started the company 5 years ago, as I was saying, we set out on a mission to really try to scale the commercial industrial sector. And perhaps out of naivete or a little bit of foolishness, we thought that we could apply software and technology to do that, because obviously that had already been happening in residential. And my co-founder, Steve Atherton, was the VP of engineering at Sungevity at the time. And previously, he'd been the CTO and VP of engineering of Sunrun. So he and his team had built two of the largest data platforms to really drive the proliferation of residential systems. And utility scale systems had already begun to slow down. So it's sort of an obvious that, like, well, C&I is ready to take off. The naivete there is that C&I, the very nature of C&I, commercial and industrial, is you have many different interests on the property, right? It is the very definition is that there is economic activity going on, and there are people who, whether they have revenues through a factory, I gave a hospital example, even multifamily, right? You have all these different stakeholders, and you also have all sorts of different rights and overlays. They're very complex. And what we came to appreciate was there are a couple things that were necessary here. One was you really had to work with partners who were the local influencers. And so we wound up working with two sets of parties. One is large national commercial real estate groups, and the other, the local developers who have all the local knowledge, relationships, and expertise. Technology was very important because it could deal with all the different combinations and complexities, but then you still need a human being and someone who has those relationships to help do the negotiations or get things done. And then the other was you needed a heck of a lot of money to do this. Because now you just can't like give people the tools. You have to fund procurement of panels, equipment, and really the fundamental change here was storage, which we've alluded to a couple times. So we wound up acquiring our own battery supply chain. So we bought a battery systems integrator. We had the good fortune of being backed by what became the NCAP Energy Transition Fund, which has $1.2 billion under management, and we're their largest single company. We also have other private equity groups behind us, including Yorktown and Innosphere, plus additional sources beyond that. We're also very fortunate to have multiple large tax equity partners, which is another issue you have to bring in, as well as debt providers, now creating a complete capital stack. But then you can use that technology and that procurement power to basically buy at utility scale pricing, but then deploy locally through your partners. And I joke a little bit with some of our renewable energy local developers. Our job is to give them freedom from and freedom to. Freedom from all the headaches of procurement and finance and overhead and operations, to give them freedom to go and do that specialized work locally. And that's really that magic that happens at CNI, because now you can be creative. You can listen to that customer, you can find out what their needs are locally, and then you can configure, not customize, configure a solution of that combination of technologies we talked about that suits their needs, including remote offtake. So we provide community solar as kind of mini utility scale to feed in and complement what isn't available on-prem. So then it's that integrated solution of all four of those components, on-prem solar, battery storage, EV charging, and then remote offtake, that then you dial and adjust, but then you work with other people to get it done.
I have a question for you, if you can maybe help us simplify the business model, which is very interesting, by the way. Mm-hmm. But what are, say, Catalyze's revenue streams? What are people giving you the dollars for?
Yeah. So the simplest answer is we sell electricity, right? We're an independent power producer. We make electricity through solar panels. And then the solar on-prem versus off-prem is just location. Battery storage is, you know, way to store it, make it available when it's needed. And then EV charging is frankly just another way to sell the same product, just in a differentiated form. So the simple answer is we sell electricity. Now, the reason why I go back to that telecommunications example of back, you know, 40 years ago, a phone company just sold long distance for the most part. And then they had like a fixed charge for a subscriber charge. It's just, if you go back to an old phone bill, it looks a lot like a utility bill. Electricity bill today, where you have a long distance charge, a local charge, a phone rental charge, like it almost lines up. So what you're seeing is moving an evolution from just volumetric PPAs, where you know you're paying cents per kilowatt hour for your generation, to now you're starting to look at these other revenue sources that you were alluding to. You know, sometimes we call this the value stack, but one of the big things is demand response to the utility. These assets, these distributed assets, are friends to the utility. Half the costs in general of the grid are to serve the top peak events each year. So the fact that people like us are going out and funding battery storage is absolutely to the benefit of the utilities. Like, hey, people are making free, no cost to you, dispatchable power plants. Just pay them a little extra to now reduce those peak events and do it right by the load. Either on, so the load never hits your grid, or kind of in the neighborhood, de-stresses the whole system, reduces avoided costs, and can make the system last longer. I already mentioned EV charging. That's an upsell and a cross-sell, but there are other revenue streams that then make that sale electricity just a little bit different depending on the use.
Which obviously is part of transition, which I like. I think if we go back a little bit in terms of, you mentioned the analogy with AT&T and the mobile or the telecom network, probably before mobile, but with my background in this, I also capitalized a little bit on this and also used the functionality of it. But what I think is quite interesting is that if you go back X amount of years ago, it was communication. Okay, it was critical, but probably not as business critical as energy, at least not back then. Now you can always debate, especially if you ask my son, I think why connectivity is more important. But the question here is that as a new startup company coming out on the market in this transition, even if customers are saying, yeah, we want to go for renewables, we want to be part of this journey, but you have some, do you see the utilities as competitors? How were you approached and how was the feedback from customers when you start approaching them as a new kind of a newcomer on this market where, you know, nothing can go wrong because if it does, the kind of the business goes down. So how was that kind of the early days meeting customers and discussion? What was the impression and has that changed a lot in the since 17 when you kind of kicked off?
Yeah, well, I think there are a couple different questions there.
Probably.
Yeah. Starting with today, key question, are utilities competitors or somehow enablers or friends? I think that's the utility's own decision. There are certain utilities that are absolutely enablers and have already embraced the world of being market makers. And that distributed generation is part of the future. It's really just a question of the rate of change, not if there's change. There certainly are utilities who haven't made that choice yet. And frankly, many of them may be forced to through the financial consequences of where the markets are going. We're looking at an inflationary environment. We're looking at a lot of load defection. And we're looking at technologies that are making it harder and harder for utilities to control what end users makes the choices they make and whether or not they self-generate. So I think utilities are eventually in the United States eventually going to come around to the idea of being market makers. It's certainly where the future is going to be. As to the early days, I've always said the number one thing we're selling around here is trust. To your point, this is infrastructure. It is not done lightly. And there are several things that have happened along the journey that I think have really helped establish and engender trust. First of all, the people around here who joined the company early and even through recently bring themselves decades of experience. So it wasn't like it may have been a new company, but the people doing it were already in many ways known to the market. But it was a new thing and the market's changing. Have certain customers, off-takers, real estate groups, other developers said, you know, no, I don't like this, or I just don't, you know, not for me now. Absolutely, of course, you're always going to get that. Some of the earliest customers got the vision and said, oh, we see where the future is going. We want to be part of it. Because the biggest motivation with our real estate groups is not saving money on an electric bill. Most of the time, they don't pay their electric bill. It's their tenants or their operation side or their customers for the products they're making on-prem saying, we want to see you make your environmental sustainability and governance goals and not do it by just buying Texas wind RECs. We want you to point to a physical asset that's coupled with what you're doing and you can attribute your activity because we have a choice of where we buy our products or where we rent our space or what type of real estate we occupy, and we want those ESG goals met. So really, this is their revenue. And once it touched their revenue, it was a question of how can you do it, not if you're going to do it.
That's a very interesting point. So you'd say that your major clients, these are real estate nationwide corporations, their main driver towards catalyze is not necessarily a desire for sustainability. It's the bottom line that they see after they approach you?
Yes. So we have two sets of customers or partners, but they do meet at the same point at the other end. The first are medium to large commercial real estate groups, industrial, multifamily, healthcare, cold storage, people who tend to have fairly large properties, complex properties. But a very, very important point is they're multi-jurisdictional. All of them are spread across many states. And the very common theme has been, yeah, we did one or two with a local contractor, developer, and then we asked them to go down the street and they couldn't. They couldn't go to the next state. They couldn't go to the next utility jurisdiction. And we said, that's right. All development's local. You need to bring in that expertise. And one of the great things around here is Catalyze is operating in 20 different states today. We built from the get-go and we're, again, had the good fortune of having the money to do it, a nationwide platform. The other key partner are those local developers and EPCs who said, wow, we have people we're working with who we either can't cope with or we're too small to get batteries. Our customers want batteries. I can't even get one of the vendors to return a phone call. I said, well, that's procurement's not really your core competence. Procurement's something you have to do. It's a necessary evil for you to serve your customer and develop that project. So let us work with you and be your partner and let you focus on the development because we want to be the long-term owner and operator. Because both those parties have said, hey, you know, 5 years ago, maybe even 4 years ago, building a solar array and walking away from it made sense. Like you're going to sign a long-term PPA, clip coupons. But Marcelo, this goes to your point about forms of revenue. Our view is every project is not a destination. COD, commercial operations for it, is the start of the journey. We are overwhelmingly expecting these projects to evolve, be added on to, change. They're going to be living organisms, adding storage, adding a second array, time shifting, adding in more controls, going inside the building. I thought that would be something that would take longer. We're already getting requests. Can you please control the consumption of electricity and time it with the generation because we have particular requirements? So now we have another universe that was all by itself, the energy services companies, now beginning to say, oh, wow, we need to couple with generation. And now that I'm actually controlling load and designing load to be with it, now we're back to that, you know, 1870s factory, right? It's all together. It's all beginning to operate. But now it's computer controlled. It's solid state. You're not running a boiler. The solar panels just sit there and you write software to manage it all. It's really exciting. But you've got to be taking it. This is a 20 to 30 year journey.
That's something very interesting. I think I wouldn't have assumed that you are, you know, so invested in the long-term evolution of this project. And that word to me sort of stood up. And I wonder how much of, because you do solar and solar plus storage and EV charging, and I wonder how much of your current business is what of each segment? How much of it's solar versus solar plus batteries versus solar plus batteries and EV charging stations? And where do you see, you know, in 5-10 years, Catalyze's, you know, share? How much of, you know, in 2030, how much of your business is going to be EV charging? Or do you see those segments still keeping, you know, the same market shares?
Well, there are a couple of easy answers, and then there's the crystal ball answer, you know, to that. The easy answer is that, you know, today in most jurisdictions, you're looking at mostly solar still. However, whenever we're building any project, we're investing in all the connections, right? Because we're looking at being the long-term owner. We want to go into a property once to put in the smart infrastructure and then add on. So we will put in extra conduit for batteries. We will lay in for extra EV chargers. Several of our partners, one we made an announcement last week, is Stream Realty. They do about $1 billion of industrial warehouse construction, new construction a year. So we actually design in with them this future vision of what the energy infrastructure is going to look like, not day one, which is what an EPC coming in to put up a solar array is going to do. We're designing for year 20. And so we will put in the right size service panel, bring in the right service. We're redesigning services with them in order to accommodate modularity, expansion. There are also, when you really start getting into this, there are all sorts of details that you begin to address when you start trying to future-proof, you know, as a common engineering term, designing for the future instead of, well, I'm going to do this one project and maybe you get called back or later. So in some ways, your answer is, well, every project is solar storage and EV. Right now, the majority of what's being used and installed is, you know, solar panels and direct solar generation. Battery storage is very much a thing on the coasts, where we have very high transmission distribution charges and demand charges. So batteries we are deploying at multiple sites, including community solar sites to support the grid. EV chargers, we currently budget in about 10% of the vehicles in a parking lot, but we're future-proofing and forecasting for 100%. That 100% may come a lot faster than we expect.
So maybe a follow-up on this, because I think it's quite interesting. We're talking about, you mentioned also the new build and in order to build sustainable. So that's obviously a main part now, from anything on the material to what you use, et cetera. It's a smaller market, I can understand, versus a retrofitted solution to an existing one. But where do you see? Do you see any differences in terms of growth and opportunities, even if the markets are slightly skewed towards size? But do you see any differences in terms of take up on the new builds for Catalyze versus kind of the retro fitted, if that's the right word to use?
Yeah. So, well, again, when you're working with commercial real estate as your partner, you will come in and do a retrofit, right? They'll say, we want our existing portfolio or existing operations. And in those cases, you know, your costs are higher and it's a little bit more delicate and a little bit more, you know, the way things have been done, because most renewable energy has been retrofits. It's just the nature of it. But the other thing is when you form a national partnership, and again, this is just one of these things that we're able to do because we spread across the country, is a lot of these groups, they have scheduled maintenance or rebuilds. So we're actually working in with these parties, not just on new build, but when they acquire new properties, for example, which a lot of them are doing. It's been a very hot real estate market. One of the things that some of these groups will do when they acquire a set of properties is they're immediately going and doing retrofits themselves. Well, and they're doing upgrades, right? They bought this to be more successful real estate group. So they're going in and doing a set of features and enhancements based upon their strategy. And they've gone out to buy undervalued properties, right? Buy low, sell high. Nothing new, you know, in business here. So they all kind of pride themselves on buy low and they want to improve them. And whether they're long-term hold or then they sell, often they're going in and touching. So you may come in and do some retrofits, but then you just want to get on their schedule and draft with them. Because then you're both going into the building and you have one set of electricians, you have one set of civil plans. I think the hardest ones, and this is back where, you know, it comes back to the importance of utilities and centralized generation, are things like dense urban vertical buildings, right? Here, on-premise self-generation doesn't work really well at all, right? You got a big load, big vertical building. It's very expensive to bring things in. And this is really the utility strength. And especially when you're looking at vehicle electrification in urban settings, that's when, again, your partnership is really beginning to build, because, you know, some of our actual discussions with utilities have been along the lines of, well, hey, if you focus and solve a problem over here, we can devote resources and solve this one over there. Again, this is just a differentiated role. You know, the big campus out in the suburbs or in a rural area, very much our strength, especially if there's limited infrastructure, because now you can start off with smart infrastructure. Some downtown vertical building that's in the same portfolio, hey, let's work with the, you know, utility and maybe we feed the community solar into that and support that. Maybe we put some battery storage and maybe we run the EV chargers to, but then we're partnering with the utility to give them benefit too. I think this is totally win-win-win, but you know, it's not, there's not one size fits all. You got to dial those attributes appropriately.
So you mentioned that you sometimes work with utilities to see what's the best solution for your portfolio. And a couple questions ago, you also mentioned that, and correct me if I'm wrong, Catalyze is now operating in 20 out of the 50 states in the U.S.?
Correct. Yes.
So, and I don't know which states, but yeah. why, what's different in those states and not the other 30? Is it more, less infrastructure, less density, easier relationships with utilities? Is it a policy thing that makes one state more attractive than the other to your business model?
It's where our real estate partners asked us to go. So they will typically give us, whenever we start a relationship, a list of 200 to 1,000 properties. These are the scale of parties that we work with. The first thing we do is we run that through our software platform. So we're very technology enabled now. We're running over 10 terabytes of data that has ownership information, parcel information, topography, irradiance data. We actually auto design in the software rooftop arrays. So there's auto detection to remove like obstructions, elevator shafts, air handling equipment, shading. There's automatic shading analysis. And in a very short period of time, not only can we come back and generate, well, here's the size of the arrays, but we also have 785,000 archetypical buildings with 30 years of empirical load data. So we actually generate an automatic, pretty close 8760 load profile. So we can look at those two and say, well, here's without pulling utility bills, without you giving us anything else besides an address, here's our sense of where the economics are falling for those buildings. Here's a ranking by the utility zones based upon some of the other things like price, value of energy, transmission and distribution, net metering costs, incentive programs, whether or not that area may be, for example, in a study and kind of on a hold. And then we will jointly prioritize. And they often say, hey, that list looks really good, but these, you got to move up to the top of the list. We have tenants who want them. There's a particular demand. And we say, okay, well, how are we, again, going to phase this? Maybe it doesn't make sense to do a 2-megawatt array with battery storage and a whole bunch of EV charging for a fleet, which is a real example. They said, yeah, the prospective tenant said they're probably going to go to fleet electrification, but not for a year or two. Which is say, that's good. Why don't we just do one array right now for the building load? And then we'll just lay out and be all ready to get going with the second one as soon as they want it. And, you know, again, that day may come sooner than we expect when gas is $4 to $5 a gallon in the United States. I mean, again, the winds are at our back, pun intended, on this. When you've got, you know, increased inflation, electricity prices, inflation and fuel, and both the massive consumption of electricity for commercial use and transportation fuel converge at C&I properties. So we are getting a lot of you can't move fast enough right now.
So if we look at switching gear a little bit from actually the generation on the software and talk a little bit about the EV and the charging, which as a European, I don't know, it's interesting to hear also in the US where you see the differences. But first question, maybe what role do you play in that kind of EV charging? Is it the installation or the energy? Is it the charging incidents? Is there, you know, the apps, so whatever needs to be done. But quite interesting just to hear your role around this. And then as a follow-up question is then, who do you work with in terms of, you mentioned the customer saying that they're not ready for this. Do you also work with kind of the fleet managers to see when they're ready? Or how does this work? Because it's infrastructure for EVs is, wherever you are, a big topic. And
absolutely.
Lagging behind. It's lagging behind by far. So it'll be interesting just to hear your, first of all, what is your role today on this? And how do you kind of match this also with then the tenants, but being that fleet manager, for example?
Yeah. Well, the simple business model answer is we sell electricity, right? We generate electricity, we sell electricity. That's how we make our money. Now, EVs start turning into a special type of electricity. This is where we start looking at electricity as a differentiated good, because the value of that electricity has to also now factor into what is that vehicle used for? How long is it going to be there? How far does it have to go? On a single use case, that's relatively easy to address. When you start talking about a fleet, it starts getting really complicated. So to answer your question, do we work with fleet managers? Absolutely. They're coming to us saying, hey, we know we're worried about our fuel prices. Gas is through the roof. Diesel's even higher. We've been talking about fleet electrification because we've heard not only these electric trucks in particular coming, but that they're lower cost per mile because they have no maintenance, right? There's like no parts to them. There's no transmission. There's no water pump. You know, you basically replace tires. And so we'd love to go EV, but we run into a whole bunch of problems. So when we talk to these fleet managers, these property owners, they say a couple of things. First of all is we talk to the utility and it's going to cost this huge amount of money to bring in a total new service to support everything. Two, well, we have to put all these chargers in, and that's going to cost a lot of money. And we don't actually really know what's going to happen. Like it just seems complicated, in which we say, you're right, it can be, it doesn't have to be. So we made an investment as a company, strategic investment last year in a company called Microgrid Labs. And a couple solutions here that are sort of joint here. First of all, again, we're generating as much electricity as possible on-prem to minimize what the utility has to bring in, and especially in existing expensive infrastructure like California or the Northeast, bringing in new service is really expensive. So if we can alleviate that or reduce that expense, it's a huge win that then turns into making it possible. And generation plus storage takes care of that. But on the EV side directly, now you start saying, well, let's think about how to optimize it. So do all those trucks have to charge at the same time? Well, no. Some of them are out for delivery. Some of them aren't. And well, do you have a route optimization software today? Oh, yeah, of course we do. That's what we do. We're a logistics business. Well, great. What if we coupled that with the generation and timed the fuel with the truck? So what Microgrid Labs does, and we've incorporated it in our solution now, is to say, well, you've got a, let's say, 2-megawatt array on this logistics warehouse. It generates so much electricity. You've got these 10 trucks for simplicity. Some are going, some are back. Why don't you start changing the routes and changing the time to match not just the deliveries they have to do, but now adding in the fuel? And here's your schedule for today. So that outputs a joint schedule that now not only adds delivery as if fuel were totally available, to say, well, let's now optimize this with the fuel. And in some cases you say, you know what, this delivery is so important, or this mission is so important, we want to pay extra for that. Okay, great. We'll draw from the grid. We'll use DCFC. We'll upgrade the infrastructure to support that, because now it's all cost benefit, right? These are the type of calculations and advice we give fleet managers to say, hey, we're looking at a new kind of whole system, and we just need to find out what your optimum is. And if you outgrow it, you've made it modular to then just expand as you need it. In some ways, it's very simple, and in some ways, it's a lot of math.
So what are your views then? Because this is, I think, is moving in the right direction. So you produce the energy, you use it for the buildings, you connect it to someone that installed the EV chargers, and the software in terms of the app and charging elsewhere is done by someone else. But the energy is definitely flowing through this. What are your views then on vehicle to grid, but maybe before vehicle to grid, vehicle to building, if that's kind of the word to use? How do you utilize
it? Just another option. So that's still extremely emergent. It is a topic around here and a requirement, again, in future proofing So we buy our chargers from a variety of third parties.
Yeah.
We run them and we run the software. So one of our requirements is that all our partners in EV charging have the open standard, because we're going to do things like say, well, does your vehicle need to be charged right now? Or does it need, how fast does it need to be charged? So we may, you know, vary the electricity and the rate going to that charger. So again, that's part of where it's a little more complicated. But this is also one of the big changes we've seen in the market. Again, a few years ago, people would say, I'll do it myself. You know, let me just pay a contractor, put solar up, I'll net meter, like how hard this can be. Today, you start getting to these examples and a commercial property that says, we can't wing it. We have class A tenants, investment grade, top tier tenants who want to rent our space. They want smart infrastructure. And they say, that's not our business. Our business is being a real estate company, or our partner is, hey, we're the local developer, knows how to get things done in our area. This long-term, like, keep it running, optimize it, evolve it, that's what Catalyze does. So Catalyze will take on all that responsibility and say, hey, we're going to keep those trucks running on time. We're going to make sure that array works. And we're going to do things like maybe buy wholesale electricity to supplement if we need to do it. But again, that's the beauty of an interoperable complex network. You know, I think this is a bit of a head scratcher for people when we talk about electricity, because we're so habituated to this 100-year history of big power plants. If we were having the same conversation about computers, nobody would be saying, what are you going to do about the mainframe? You know, we still have this mainframe. You got this like personal computer here. I don't understand how it's going to work with like your mobile phone and, you know, the other computers, and like, how is the data going to move on the net? This is just so complicated. We have people who specialize this, and you have companies provide routers, and the phone just works with the computer, right? It took us 25, 30 years. Electricity is moving faster, but the fact that my house might be powered by my neighbor's house today is invisible to me. It should be invisible to me. I really shouldn't care. And someone, whether it's a utility or an independent power producer, is supposed to be a network manager making sure it happens. Catalyze is just being the network manager on that parcel. And we want to work with the utility to be the network manager in the neighborhood and the service territory.
Which I think is interesting. And I think we're also running a little bit out of time. We're coming up to the hour. Summarizing a little bit what I've heard today, I thought it was really good to have you on, James, and I really appreciate not only the topic expertise, but also the enthusiasm you have. We always like when guests have enthusiasm. That means that something is driving. I like the analogy between where we were 100 years ago and that we're actually coming to this again, which I thought was really, really interesting, that this is actually new technology. Maybe it might be new ways of utilizing digital, but it's actually an infrastructure that we had before we changed it about 100 years ago. I thought that was quite interesting. I also like the way, in terms of the interest, and also not just the interest from the facility owners, but also from the tenants, that this is going and start producing it through solar and then connecting it through the EVs. We'll see where the EVs goes. I'm still very interested in terms of the vehicle to house, the vehicle to buildings, and all the rest, and utilizing the batteries. But that's another story. I would love to talk more about the investment part, but unfortunately that's because energy is capital intense, and it's also around a lot of that investments. But I really, really enjoyed this show. But maybe Marcelo, last few words, last question we squeeze in.
Oh, I want to say that I love that statement about Texan investors. You know, there's a reason why Texas is the second largest onshore wind market, and it's not specifically because of sustainability concerns or a desire to push, you know, the envelope when it comes to the energy transition. There was money to be made because there was a lot of wind there, and, you know, Texas went there and did it. So I am no financial analyst, but if they're investing in Catalyze, it means they're smelling the money. So that's a good sign from my point of view.
Which is great. And I think that on the show quite a few times, being a little bit of an outsider sitting in Europe, looking into the American market and hearing a lot about Houston, Texas. And I know Chris went there not long ago. I have to start booking my trip. I need to see what actually goes on there. But Fantastic to have you on. James, any final words from you?
Well, thank you again for having me. And yeah, a couple parting comments to our fellow energy professionals here. One, which is something I say around here all the time, is the only thing certain is change. And personally, I find that exciting. I realize to certain people that somewhat horrifying and frightening. But energy transition is a word that started being used after we started the company. And it really sort of hit on what we were doing. And I'm really glad we're embracing it because it really is energy transition. And the other is something that my mother's always said to me. She says, James, you know, why are you complaining about something? It's the hard problems that are worth solving. Other people go solve the easy ones. Everybody says they want to solve the hard ones, but most people gravitate towards the easy ones. So take on the really hard ones because no one's ever going to shame you for trying. So go try energy transition. There are a lot of things to solve, but they are, for the most part, solvable. And that's what's going to make this an exciting and better world. And we need to. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think that also wrapped up a little bit of the insider's guide of energy, of the topic what we want to hear and what we want to bring on to the show to actually drive this one. For our listeners, you've been listening or watching to another episode of Insider's Guide to Energy. As we always do at the end of the show, make sure that you promote our show on social media. Tell your friends. And until next week, bye-bye.